This download is made possible by all the generous folks who support public radio. If that includes you, thank you. If not, become a contributing member to your local station. And now, here's the show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and we are seeing red this hour in more ways than one. Red lines in Iraq, where the militant forces move closer to Baghdad and where a decision point approaches for the United States. The U.S. is said to be considering placing troops on the ground to bolster security at the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. Will additional special forces be added to assist in directing U.S. air cover if needed? Also this hour, seeing red in the confidence, sexiness, and sheer power of red lipstick. And the Supreme Court wants to sift through inflammatory Facebook speech to distinguish between therapy and felonious threats. But first, most of the major cities in northern Iraq are now in the hands of the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, the Sunni Islamist group known as ISIS. ISIS is busy building infrastructure around the city of Mosul, even as they are fighting for more territory near the city of Bakuba, barely 50 miles from Baghdad. With a view from the outskirts of Mosul to the outskirts of Baghdad, Jane Araf joins us now. She's a reporter for Al Jazeera America and the Christian Science Monitor. Jane, is Baghdad crumbling?
Well, it's certainly crumbling around the edges, but it's been crumbling for a while. You know, I think we have to remember, essentially, this country is now split. If it wasn't split before, it is split along political lines. The Kurds in an increasing position of power here, given that they're now responsible for security, and all of the fighting, and not just fighting, all of the political unrest that we're seeing in many other parts of Iraq, including the outskirts of Baghdad. It's a very volatile situation. I mean, it's volatile at the best of times, but you sort of get the sense now that you light a match, the whole place could go up. It's everything is changing. Everything is in flux.
Is ISIS gathering strength as it moves through communities? Are Sunnis joining up, or are they simply disappearing into the countryside to await the violence to end?
That's a great question. It's actually both. And that's part of the reason why ISIS has been able to take over these cities and towns. One of the fascinating dynamics here that we're seeing is that this is a group, ISIS, which rose out of Al-Qaeda, really, that seems to have become quite a lot more sophisticated, not only about how to take cities and topple Iraqi security forces, but about how to retain the ground that they've taken. And what I mean by that is when they went into Mosul, they didn't do it by themselves. They teamed up with former Baathists, with some of the fighters from Anbar, and they have a very uneasy alliance, but one that has so far held. Now what they're trying to do is show people that they're the kinder, gentler face of that organization and that they can actually run a city. So they're cleaning up the streets. They've taken away the blast barriers. They're providing more water and electricity. And they're being very savvy about this. So there are some people who have joined up with them, particularly from Anbar. A lot of the fighters are, particularly the younger fighters. And there are a lot of Iraqis who do what Iraqis have always done since Saddam Hussein, which is wait on the sidelines and see who's going to win.
And they have to demonstrate this sort of civic sophistication. And it sounds like they're using something of a Hamas model in Gaza to deliver services to people in Baghdad and the surrounding areas. Do they also control air assets? I would suspect there's a lot of materiel that they could get their hands on this march from Mosul all the way down to the outskirts of Baghdad.
Well, they don't control fighter planes or the limited number of fighter planes that Iraq has or helicopters, as far as we know. But so far, they haven't needed to. They've been able to take control of some of the tanks, some of the heavy machine guns, anti-aircraft guns, and they seem pretty well armed. I mean, it indicates that there has been an infusion of both money and weapons, apart from those that they've managed to capture from Iraqi security forces. So really what we're talking about is something that's much more complicated and much harder to fight than it would be if this were simply a battle where air assets would be the defining factor. Mosul is probably multiple times more complicated than Fallujah. And you know how complicated Fallujah is. Mosul is a much bigger city. It's split along sectarian and ethnic lines. It has almost every ethnic group in it. And so to do battle there involves the kind of urban fighting that's always been difficult. It was difficult for the Americans. It's almost impossible even for Iraqi security forces, even if they were there, which they're not, having melted away and abandoned most of their posts.
And are the weapons a combination of U.S. weapons and Soviet-era weapons, or is it mostly old Iraqi tanks and armored personnel carriers from days gone by?
Well, it's both. A lot of the arms that the Iraq has bought in recent years have included American arms and weapons, including American tanks. They're still buying from the Russians. They're buying from pretty much anyone they can buy arms from because they do have quite a lot of money and they have a lot of security concerns. So they've been going on a bit of a spending spree. So it's really a wide variety of them. The new American weapons that the Iraqi government is trying to get include more fighter jets delivered faster. They're ordering more Hellfire missiles. The Iraqi government under Nouri al-Maliki, the prime minister, has asked for all kinds of help.
So have you talked to people in Baghdad who say, if this and this happens, I'm out of here?
Absolutely. The flights out of Baghdad are already almost entirely full with middle-class families leaving. It's a good time to leave anyway. School is almost over. It's getting really hot. It's the time of year when it's not that difficult to say, we'll just go away for a month or so and see what happens. But that, as we know, is a middle-class, upper-class luxury. There are millions of people here who can't leave. And we're seeing that in Mosul. You know, on the outskirts of Mosul, where I've been the past few days, just 10 miles from Mosul, I was in an ancient monastery the other day, and there were families there who said that they were going to have to go back because they had fled in terror and they were staying at the monastery, but they were worried about losing their jobs. They didn't have the money to sustain them. They don't own their houses. They're kind of in a precarious situation anyway, so they have no choice, as they see it, but to go back to their homes, no matter how dangerous the situation is.
Jane Araf, a journalist covering Iraq for Al Jazeera America and the Christian Science Monitor, speaking to us from northern Iraq. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We now bring in Richard Perl, who served as Assistant Secretary of Defense to Ronald Reagan and was chairman of the Defense Policy Board, a close advisor to Donald Rumsfeld, from 2001 to 2003. Richard Perl, welcome to The Takeaway.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
So with the stipulation that weapons of mass destruction were not found in Iraq and an imminent threat to the United States from Iraq was not discovered in the early invasion in 2003, what do you think has been the principal value of U.S. intervention in Iraq, looking back these many years?
Well, I believe the elimination of Saddam Hussein, and a more murderous tyrant would be difficult to find, was in itself a very beneficial thing. I'm afraid we didn't handle the post-Saddam situation very well, but certainly eliminating him was a good thing for all mankind. I also thought and believed the administration agreed with this, that immediately after that, we should turn Iraq over to an interim government to prepare for elections. We didn't do that. We became occupying power. And I think that was a tragic mistake.
So the turning point for you was not to have implemented the coalition provisional authority and to have gone immediately to some sort of interim Iraqi government. Is that a fair characterization?
That's correct. Once we became an occupying power, we created the political climate in which the insurgency was able to grow and expand. And that's where the trouble really began.
So whose mistake was that? George Bush supported that. Donald Rumsfeld supported that. Tommy Frank supported that.
All the above. The original plan, as I understood it, although I had no hand in designing it, was that once Saddam was removed from office, we would, in fact, turn things over to the Iraqis. But when Ambassador Bremer was sent to Baghdad, with that plan in mind, he reported back that he didn't believe the Iraqis were ready to assume responsibility. And unfortunately, the rest of the administration acquiesced in that judgment. And so we found ourselves running a violent occupation.
You know, there were a lot of claims at the time. Paul Wolfowitz made claims that the war would pay for itself. You even said at a certain point that this would not last months. It would last more than days, but not months. Where did those claims come from? And when they clearly were shown to be incorrect, how were the adjustments made in policy? On the fly?
Well, in fact, Saddam was out in 21 days. The question of what we did after that is, of course, the point that remains to be debated. But you can't rewind history, so I can't prove to you that had we turned things over to the Iraqis, it might have gone differently. I believed that was the right thing to do at the time.
You were asked in 2013 if you thought the war was worth it, looking back 10 years, and your answer was, I've got to say, I think it's not a reasonable question. What we did at the time was done in the belief that it was necessary to protect this nation. You can't a decade later go back and say, well, we shouldn't have done that. Let me ask the question in a slightly different way. If Saddam was still in power and the 5,000 U.S. soldiers who died in Iraq were alive and nothing had happened in 2003, would we be in a better situation today than we are now?
I think that's an absurd question with all candor, because you're asking for a judgment a decade after decisions were made in order to accomplish a specific purpose, which was managing the risk associated with Saddam Hussein in power with, as we believed at the time, chemical and biological weapons. And no one can tell you what Saddam might have done had he been able to remain in power. I think there is every reason to expect that he would have rebuilt his arsenal. The sanctions that were then confronting him would have gone long ago. In fact, it was very hard to hold on to the sanctions even then. I just don't think it's productive to look at it in that way.
All right. Well, then, if my question is absurd, is it not at least bordering on the absurd for you to say what we did at the time was done in the belief that it was necessary to protect this nation? You can't go back a decade later and say we shouldn't have done that. Doesn't that, in fact, justify all decisions of policy and make it impossible for anyone like you or Donald Rumsfeld to ever make a mistake?
No, of course, we can all make mistakes, and we do, and plenty of mistakes were made. I've referred to one that I think is of great significance, which was the failure to turn things over immediately to the Iraqis.
Well, Richard Pearl, thank you for your candor, and thank you for spending time with us. We really appreciate it.
Sure. All the best.
Richard Pearl's Assistant Secretary of Defense to President Reagan and Chairman of the Defense Policy Board from 2001 to 2003, a close advisor to Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. We're asking you this hour, as Iraq and the region continue to spiral into chaos, what responsibilities does the U.S. have?
This is Ray from Newark, Delaware. I think it would be terrible if the weaponry we left continued to kill the innocent. It's our responsibility to clean up our mess.
Or Michael Ransom wrote this on Facebook. If the Iraqi military is falling apart and deserting, we cannot even begin to get involved in this conflict. We will have to occupy to push back ISIS. Airstrikes won't be enough. We cannot and should not be at the forefront of any military aid for this country. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, be a part of the conversation, or find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
As we yearn to find models to help us understand the situation in Iraq right now and the potential longevity of the chaos there, a guest on this program yesterday had a particularly disturbing model to share, and we wanted to run it by an expert in the region. Peter Pham is director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council in Washington, D.C. Welcome to the program, Peter.
Thank you.
You know, I wanted to run this by you. Yesterday, somebody spoke with us about the situation in Iraq, and we were actually struggling to come up with models for what this is leading to in Iraq. And he posited this, and I want to play it for you.
I do not believe that Iraq will break cleanly into three separate countries. I think that although the Kurds in the north are more viable than the rest of the country if Iraq falls apart, for the rest of the country, Somalia, I think, is a much more likely scenario than a clean break into three states.
That sounded pretty plausible to me in the sense that Somaliland had a certain stability that the rest of Somalia down near Mogadishu did not, and Baidoa and Bardera and those cities. What do you make of that Somalia model? And if so, what can the people of Iraq expect over the next 10 years?
Well, I'm not a specialist in Iraq. My area of concentration, of course, is Africa. But looking at what has happened in Somalia, it's quite clear that the international community's futile efforts to impose a unity that most people don't trust in and many more oppose simply won't work. We're in Somalia, we're on, depending on how you number them, either the 15th or the 16th attempt by the international community to force Somalis into a unity under one central government, and the previous attempts have failed, and the current one is at best flailing and incapable of preventing cross-border attacks like the one, unfortunately, that hit Kenya over the weekend.
So do you think a larger population and the presence of an enormously valuable set of natural resources in the form of natural gas and oil helps the situation or inflames the situation?
Well, it can help the situation if the money is spent equitably, if power is shared, and if there's an underlying sense of national unity and national identity, which clearly is lacking, all of which is clearly lacking in Somalia. And from all appearances, Nouri al-Maliki has not done the same in Iraq.
And if we look around the world, the Somalia model is, something that we can point to in places like Congo. You know, you might point to it in Libya at this point. It's not an unusual model, and the international community doesn't have a spectacular track record in bringing national unity to a place that is resisting it at all costs.
Well, I think the international community forgets its own history. If we look at Europe, for example, how many wars over the century were fought before the Peace of Westphalia, the recognition that each state, no matter how small, had its right to its own sovereignty. And then over time, even as late as the Second World War, Europeans were redrawing borders, shifting populations. Today we call it ethnic cleansing, and I'm certainly not advocating and doing it violently, but Europe even did it as late as the 1940s, and only after that did they find a measure of stability and over time develop into the European Union that it exists today. And even now, as we saw in the recent Euro parliamentary elections, there's still tension by people in various parts of Europe who fear the loss of the nation state and their own individual identity.
So there's a plausible analysis here that the instability we're seeing in Iraq, though it may have been catalyzed by the U.S. invasion in 2003, has been incubating since 1945 on some level.
Right. And, you know, many people, certainly there's blame enough to go around, but I tend to look at Iraq and say, if the U.S. had done nothing in Iraq in 2003, would Saddam Hussein, with the brittle dictatorship that he had, would Iraq be much different today in the aftermath of 2011 and the Arab Spring? And somehow I suspect that Iraq would still be convulsed today, much like Syria. We didn't invade Syria in 2003, but the Assad family regime certainly came under challenge after the Arab Spring. So one suspects that Iraq would, the configurations may be slightly have been different. History doesn't give us that easy view down alternative paths, but one suspects that it wouldn't be that much different from what we're seeing today.
Well, that's a very interesting analysis. Peter Pham, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Peter Pham is director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council in Washington, D.C. Comparisons can and have been made between the current crisis in Somalia and Iraq. As ISIS pushes through Iraq, what responsibility does the U.S. have to Iraq and its people?
This is Jim. I'm from Alameda. And I was in uniform for 28 years. I think it's time that we used other instruments of power as a first resort. And I think that actions taken in Iraq in the past have been inappropriate. And I think in our future use of the military, I think with great power needs to come great humility.
Grand Prairie, Texas writes, it's time for the Iraqi people to resolve their own conflicts. The U.S. can no longer afford the monetary and especially the human cost of war in Iraq. Phil Newton, Saranac Lake, New York. The American public's overwhelming opposition to U.S. intervention is completely wrong. We want to unite Iraq, right? Send in every Marine and Army brigade we can spare and begin bombing immediately. That will unite them. Detroit, Michigan. As much as I would love for the U.S. to simply walk away from Iraq, we can't. Our military intervention has directly or indirectly caused the destabilization of the region. And here's Donna Rogers on Facebook. There's nothing we can do to change centuries of cultural conflict. It's not about America. It never was. Tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or follow us on Twitter. That's at The Takeaway, all one word, at The Takeaway. If in a bar brawl you scream that you're going to break someone's neck, that can be grounds for an assault charge. Same as if you scream, I have a bomb, in a crowded theater. Burn a cross on someone's lawn, though, and you may get ticketed for trespassing or vandalism, but the cross burning alone is not considered by the courts to be a threat. But what if, in the quiet of your living room, you outline a plan to kill all of your neighbors? You pick a day to burn down a school with the students in it, or attack a police department. Can you just claim that you were writing some spooky novel and that your statements are protected by the First Amendment? This is precisely the issue the U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to hear. Can the court precisely define what is threatening speech in the rough-and-tumble world of the Internet? Susan Crawford is a visiting professor at Harvard Law School and author of Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry, and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age. Susan, welcome.
Thanks so much.
So as a law professor, does the law make a distinction between, you know, bombing a crowded theater, the sort of symbolic nature of the burning cross, and the kind of speech that I outlined online, you know, a very specific plot to kill your neighbors or something?
Well, not really. We know that true threats under that opinion you talked about from 10 years ago about the cross burning, where an individual shows an intent to harm a specific person, whether they make that statement online or off, that could be grounds for a criminal prosecution. The problem here in the case that the court agreed to consider yesterday is by whose yardstick should that intent be measured? In the case they're looking at, the defendant said, oh, he was just exercising some kind of therapy by writing down individual threats on Facebook. And most courts have said, no, you look at whether an objective, reasonable person would themselves find that to be a threat to an individual and measure whether it could be a crime by that objective, reasonable outsider view rather than his internal intent.
And what will the court have to come up with? They're going to have to come up with some kind of test that certain speech, if it passes the test, qualifies as a crime. If it fails the test, then it's innocuous and benign. And they're going to kind of have to invent this test, right?
Well, most courts in the country have already said, the lower courts have already said, that if an objective, reasonable person, a listener, read what was written on Facebook and interpreted it as a specific statement of a threat to an individual or identified individual, then that's enough. It's just the Third Circuit and some other lower courts that have said, no, it can be the defendant's subjective intent that's at issue. It's a tricky case because the Supreme Court has been very protective of speech that doesn't harm people, like the outrageous protesters in the Steiner versus Phelps case, the Westboro Baptist Church, even depictions of animal cruelty, those are protected. And here, where you might create an atmosphere of fear through your threats on Facebook, law enforcement can pluck out that language and go after those people.
And that's the category of bullying. Will the court be weighing into bullying? Because I suspect a reasonable, objective judgment of a 9-year-old reading something on Facebook is a little bit different than the reasonable, objective judgment of one of their parents or just a random adult.
And that's why the stakes in this case are so high, because anybody can be a listener on Facebook, the whole nation. And a case could be brought by an individual quite distant from the threatening speaker saying, I personally felt threatened and you need to spend some time in jail.
Now, we know Justice Breyer loves this whole Internet world. He's a bit of a nerd on the court. Some of the newer justices also are intrigued by this new law. What about the rest of the court? Are they interested in getting into this? And do you have any sense of how this court might rule?
You know, for me, this case hangs in the balance. I think in general, you've got five members of the court, the traditional conservative bloc, that is very protective of law enforcement's ability to protect Americans. And this case seems to go in their direction. On the other hand, some of those same people are also the most protective of libertarian values of free speech. So they will at least be torn as they examine what yardstick by which to measure the speech, the defendant's intent, the speaker's intent, or the listener's assessment of whether a threat was actually made.
Susan Crawford, visiting professor at the Harvard Law School and author of Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age. Thanks so much.
Great to be here.
Go red. That's right. Start up your crimson Ferrari on the street and watch the heads turn. It takes a certain personality and a certain bank account to want to gather a crowd around a cloud of red that says, hey, look, a red Ferrari is equal parts masculine swagger and feminine curves. All for the tidy sum of $270,000. But you don't have to spend even close to that to get the same head turns on the street. For $20, one hot red lipstick will get you all the curves and standout horsepower you need on a summer day. Heck, author Madeline Marsh has the confidence to take on a Ferrari in a one-on-one street fight. The author of Compact and Cosmetics says strong women have been winning street battles with the color red on their lips for a lot longer than Ferraris have been around.
Red lipstick is, in fact, about female strength. Lipstick came in the 20th century, and the first and most famous manifestation of red lipstick was in fact in New York, when the suffragettes took to the streets, banded together, and as part of their defiance and their fight for the vote, they all wore bright red lipstick. And, you know, again, looking through history, you can see that during the war in Britain, I mean, cosmetics were certainly hard to come across because we were making more important things. But the lipstick that was being made was given names like Fighting Red, Patriot Red, Grenadier Red. And ladies were encouraged to look your best to do your best. So, you know, on the one hand, lipstick is always portrayed as being about sexuality. But that strong vein and the power of women and the power of presenting yourself in a sort of a strong way is always there, too.
And I don't know, you know, where that history comes from, but it's alive and well in my house. I've got three daughters, and my soft-spoken, maybe slightly reserved, I wouldn't call her shy exactly, daughter. She wears kind of skin-colored lipstick. But my other two daughters, who, you know, are kind of like, you know, fighter pilots of feminism, red lipstick all the way.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always very much been about strength. In the 1970s, lipstick went out, you know, along with shaving your legs and whatnot, and part of the feminist revolution was not wearing makeup, and makeup and cosmetics, lipstick, shaving, they were all portrayed very much as sort of patriarchal oppression. But if you think of Rosie the Riveter, I mean, there she is, this big butch lady in her overalls with arms like prize-winning hams, yet she's got hennaed hair, red nail varnish, and bright red lipstick. So, you know, you can be a lipstick feminist quite happily.
Now, isn't there this kind of, you know, anthropological kind of emphasize the lips because, you know, they are already emphasized, right? And so that's...
I think it always makes sense to emphasize the most expressive parts of your face. But, yeah, really, since the dawn of time, woman has decorated herself. And the earliest representation that I found of lipstick was an ancient Egyptian papyrus. And this was, in fact, an erotic papyrus. So it was the Egyptian version of a girly magazine. And there was a picture of a giant phallus on top of which was seated a naked lady calmly painting her lips. And, yeah, exactly like those 40s pin-ups. You might have no clothes on, but blow me, your hair and makeup were always going to be perfect.
Sitting comfortably on a giant phallus. Did you just say that, Madeline?
I did. I have no shame.
Yeah.
You see, once I've got my red lipstick on, that's it. Fear is just a memory. But what do you feel about red lipstick on a woman?
I think it's great. I mean, I think it's absolutely great. I mean, I do wonder, that must require a lot of maintenance because, you know, it does tend to fade as time goes on. And, you know, it's hard to keep that, you know, that Ferrari red look, you know, that you want. But you know, I am amazed at how quickly and stealthily women can kind of, you know, redo the paint job there.
Oh, well, one of my favorite sights is on the tube in the morning in London. When you see girls doing this full makeup, like everything, so they come in, you know, barefaced, and by the time they've gone five stops, they've done the whole thing. And what, you know, what's interesting about lipstick and about makeup was that, you know, initially, yeah, I didn't say in the very early 20th century it was regarded as, you know, terrible. You had to be a prostitute or an actress if you were painting your face. But when cosmetics and lipsticks became acceptable, which was after World War One, suddenly what came with them, and in fact invented by you, well, not you personally, obviously, but I'm taking you as a representative of your nation, invented by the Americans, was the portable, the metal lipstick tube with the push-up lever and the swiveling lipstick. And once you could, you know, put these things, once they were safely packaged, no stopping them. And it became acceptable to put your makeup on in public. But, you know, not everybody liked it. And a great opponent of this was Coco Chanel, who, in fact, thought that red lipstick and red nail varnish were both exquisitely vulgar, hated the fact that ladies, when they came to her house, would leave their little cosmetic cases on the table. It's very vulgar. How can they do that? And was furious. She said, as the red lipstick, it marked my glasses and my table linen. If they come like that, I give them paper serviettes.
And if you look at the old, you know, ads in newspapers and magazines, I mean, it's really a throwback to the 1700s without all of the heavy rigging. You know what I mean?
Ads are fascinating because I know, you know, cosmetics and lipstick, it can seem like quite a trivial subject, ooey, very girly. But in fact, it's about much more than that because it shows us what we expect women to be at particular periods. You know, like, say, the war thing, when, you know, having your lipstick on was part of your fight against the enemy. And actually, while we're on the topic of war, Hitler hated lipstick, said it was made from animal fat rescued from sewage. The Aryan ideal was a pure, unscrubbed face, and visitors to Hitler's sort of country retreat, they were actually given, lady visitors were given a little list of things they must not do, avoid excessive cosmetics, avoid red lipstick, and on no account ever to colour their nails.
So I know you're married now, and
I
don't want to you know, create any problems here. Of course he is. But can you give me a case of where you know that your evening, your date, your romantic encounter really hinged upon the lipstick and that that was the thing that was working for you?
Gee, well, you know what? No, because I think men don't really notice a lot of the time. And I think the people who notice are women. And I really think it's about how we feel about ourselves. And I look back over the list of my husbands and boyfriends, and I don't think any of them really give a monkey's, quite frankly. I think it's about how you feel about yourself, and that makes you attractive.
Wisdom for the ages from Madeline Marsh, the author of Compact and Cosmetics. Thanks so much.
Thank you indeed.
The men don't pay attention. All that, and we're just ignoring it. Oh, well. From Iraq to red lipstick in 60 short little minutes, a typical journey in the day of a takeaway listener. Stay with us. Catch up on all our conversation at thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Reputation.com. encouraging everyone to check their online search results, because search results define you or your business. Learn more at reputation.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.